For those of you who have been at Seven Hills over the last few weeks, you know that we're in a series right now on Isaiah. And so I've been sort of giving a little bit of a recap each week about Isaiah. But just to give you another quick one with a different angle, Isaiah was written about 800 years before Christ. And so the book of Isaiah, all 66 chapters, are about really 2,800 years old. So it's really an older book. And at the time of the writing, and really, again, Isaiah's ministry comprises about 60 years. So he's speaking primarily to Judah, and his ministry spans several different lifetimes of certain kings. But at the time, Assyria is in power. And so all you need to know about that is that the people felt very threatened by the fact that there's this big superpower on the stage. And not only that, but they know that Babylon is on the rise. They're on the horizon. And part of what Isaiah has been telling God's people is that because of your rebellion, these two countries are coming to threaten you. But part of what he offers them in their fear and in their anxiety is he offers them hope. But that hope comes in the form of a person, the Messiah, but also it comes in the promise of a future restoration where the people of Israel and the people of Judah will finally, finally surrender their hearts to God, and when they do so, they will flourish. That's true for us as well, by the way. We see these themes in some previous chapters. We're going to be in Isaiah 55 today, but in Isaiah 53, 4 through 6, we read these words, "By his stripes we are healed." It's a reference to Jesus. "The Lord has laid upon him the iniquity of us all." Again, pointing to the Messiah. Isaiah 55, 8, "He was cut off, stricken for the transgression of my people." And then Isaiah 54, which is this promise of restoration, "Enlarge the place of your tent, let the curtains of your habitations be stretched out." There's hope in the form of a Messiah, and there's hope in the form of restoration. That's true for us as well. Let's take a moment and let's pray. Father, as we read the words of Isaiah today, I pray, Father, that you would really not only help us to hear these things with our ears, but that they might chip away at some of the structures of our mind. And Father, I pray that it wouldn't just be that we hear these words and truths. It wouldn't be that we just intellectually give assent to them, Father, but I pray that these words of hope, these promises, that they would ultimately trickle down into our hearts, Father, that we might be changed from the inside out. Father, we pray all these things now in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. So in high school, like most high schoolers, I listened to a fair amount of music, and I went through a little singer-songwriter phase. These are, you know, guys who stand up on the stage by themselves with a guitar, with a beard, and they sing songs, you know, anyway. And one of the singer-songwriters that I found back in high school in 10th grade was a guy named David Wilcox, who some of you guys are probably familiar with. I actually was in Young Life at the time, and my Young Life leaders invited myself and a couple other buddies that were in, you know, also in high school, 10th grade, said, "Hey, we're going to go up to Asheville from Greenville, South Carolina, to a concert, David Wilcox concert." And so, you know, I ran it by my parents. By this point in time, my sister was out of the house and in college, so they were stress-free. They were like, "Sure, do whatever. You know, we don't care. Go." And so we drove up to Asheville, North Carolina. I think I rode up in the back of somebody's SUV and got up there to this place in Asheville, and the concert started at 8. And he played one set, and he played a second set, and he played a third set. And then after the third set, it was already about 12:30 a.m. And I'm 15 years old at the time with these, you know, Young Life leaders an hour away from home. And I remember going out to a payphone and putting in a coin and calling my parents and be like, "Hey, the concert's not even over yet. You know, there's another set to go." And sat through the fourth set and then got home probably at 2:30 in the morning. And as you might imagine, it was a pretty great evening for a 15-year-old. Well, one of the songs that David Wilcox sings and sang was a song called "That's What the Lonely Is For." That's what the lonely is for. I'm going to read just a couple of the stanzas. "The depth of your dreams, the height of your wishes, the length of your vision to see, the hope of your heart is much bigger than this, for it's made out of what might be. Now picture your hope, your heart's desire, as a castle that you must keep. In all of its splendor, it's drafty with lonely. This heart is too hard to heat. When I get lonely, that's only a sign some room is empty, and that room is there by design. If I feel hollow, that's just my proof that there's more for me to follow. That's what the lonely is for." Now, I could have sung it, but trust me, it's better for me to read it. Anyway, this song, if you can't tell by the lyrics, speaks deeply of the human condition. It speaks of desire and yet at the same time, profound emptiness. We've got this desire as human beings that is absolutely immense. In fact, it's infinite, right? And because our desire is infinite, by definition, it is unquenchable, at least by any earthly thing. And so, because of that, we experience emptiness that is on par with that desire. We try to fill up our hearts with all the things the world has to offer, but the fullness lasts only for a moment until the emptiness reappears again with a vengeance. You know what I'm talking about. You've had that experience before. You thought that thing was going to fill you up, but then the emptiness comes again. We then make the assumption that the object of our desire was actually the problem. That was the problem. We married the wrong husband. We married the wrong wife. We took the wrong career path. We bought the wrong home. The list goes on and on and on. And so we move on to a new object of our desire, only to find that the emptiness is still there. When that's happened enough times, people become jaded eventually. And eventually they just quit trying to fill the empty up at all. And instead they try to silence or extinguish their desire altogether. We simply try to seal off our hearts, but then those of us who have done that before, we know what happens. We become bitter. We become cold. We become distant. We become ultimately less human. It seems that we're either designed or destined to be prostitutes for pleasure or dry-hearted stoics. We feel trapped between our desire and our emptiness. The question is, what does the Bible have to say about all of this? Does the Bible even address this longing? Does it even address this emptiness within us? It does. We're going to read Isaiah 55. We're going to just look at verses 1 through 9. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come, buy and eat. Buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me, hear that your soul may live. And I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. Behold, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. Behold, you shall call a nation that you do not know, and a nation that did not know you shall run to you, because of the Lord your God and of the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. That's this morning, by the way. Let the wicked forsake his ways and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord that he may have compassion on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So the question is, what should we take away from this passage? As always, there's really more here than we could even begin to unpack, and so I'm really going to focus on really on two things. The first that I'm going to draw out of this is that God addresses our desire, and he addresses our emptiness. God addresses our desire, he addresses our emptiness. Look at verses 1 and 2. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. You're hungry, you're thirsty. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? Here, God is speaking in metaphor for those of you who are more concrete thinkers. He's using the symbols of physical hunger and physical thirst to address the deeper longing of our souls. In our culture, we're comfortable talking about certain desires, right? We're comfortable talking about a desire for food, for culinary desire. Think about all the TV shows, whether it's Bobby Flay or Diners and Drives and whatever that show is, or Chef's Table. You know, think about all these different food shows on TV. I mean, we even have a television network called the Food Network, where the entire channel is devoted to food. We're comfortable talking about that desire. But what's the deeper desire that is echoed beneath those TV shows, beneath that desire for food? We're comfortable talking about our desire for beautiful homes. Again, we have HGTV. It's devoted to beautiful homes. But this doesn't this just point to something deeper? We've got no problem talking about a desire for adventure, for relationships, a desire for sports. And again, there are TV and YouTube channels for each of those as well. Again, each of those only hint at our deep desires. Most of us either can't articulate the real desire beneath adventure, beneath food, or beneath a picturesque vacation, or maybe some of us are too embarrassed to discover what each of those actually means, if that makes sense. Admitting those deep desires, a deep desire for connection, a deep desire for intimacy, a deep desire for beauty, sometimes admitting those things make us feel kind of weak. They make us feel ashamed to be needy. At least they do me. Not surprisingly, C.S. Lewis addresses this very thing in his book, The Weight of Glory. Here's what he has to say. He says, in speaking of this desire for our own far-off country, which we find in ourselves even now, I feel a certain shyness. I'm almost committing an indecency. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you, the secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia and romanticism and adolescence. The secret also which pierces with such sweetness that when, in very intimate conversation, the mention of it becomes imminent, we grow awkward and affect to laugh at ourselves. The secret we cannot hide and cannot tell, though we desire to do both. We cannot tell it because it is a desire for something that has never actually appeared in our experience. We cannot hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it, and we betray ourselves like lovers at the mention of a name. C.S. Lewis, come on, man. So good. So good. He goes on to address this similar desire in Mere Christianity in somewhat less poetic form. Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for these desires exist. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. In addressing all of this, I'm actually telling you what you already know to be true. You already know this. You've got desire. You have insatiable longing. And you also know that your attempts to fulfill that desire have fallen short again and again and again. In verse 2, God addresses the emptiness that comes from this. Why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? He addresses our unsuccessful attempts to fulfill our desires apart from him. Let me return back again just for a moment to that opening song. The depth of your dreams, the height of your wishes, the length of your vision to see, the hope of your heart is much bigger than this, for it's made out of what might be. In other words, your desire is so much larger than anything the world has to offer. That's what the songwriter is hitting upon. But some of us immediately think, well, surely something can fill me up, right? Surely not everything is going to leave me empty. Surely music and art can fill the emptiness within us. Jean-Paul Sartre addressed that possibility when he wrote the following. He said this, there comes a time when one asks, even of Shakespeare, even of Beethoven, is that all there is? Even of Netflix, even of Game of Thrones, is that all there is? So what about achievement? Some of you have seen the interview with Tom Brady after he won his third Super Bowl, in which he was asked a question and he responds by saying this, why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me? I think there's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be what it's all cracked up to be. Now, by the way, he's married to a supermodel. He's got kids. He's won 3 Super Bowls. By this point in time, he's either won 6 or 7. And yet after the third, he goes, is this all there is? There's got to be more. So maybe art and beauty can't fill us up. Maybe vocation and achievement can't fill us up either. But man, what about romance, right? Come on, right? That's the thing that can fill us up. Surely that's what we were designed for. Back to that opening song by David Wilcox. Now picture your hope, your heart's desire, as a castle that you must keep. In all of its splendor, it's drafty with lonely. This heart is too hard to heat. Is it a curse or a blessing, this palace of promise, when the empty chill makes you weep with only the thin fire of romance to warm you? These halls are too tall and deep. The thin fires of romance? This is the most pessimistic sermon ever. Surely something in this world can fill us up. Listen to what philosopher and mathematician Blaise Pascal wrote after his conversion. After his conversion. What else does this craving and this helplessness proclaim but that there was once in man a true happiness, of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace? This he tries in vain to fill with everything around him, seeking in things that are not there the help he cannot find in those that are, though none can help, since this infinite abyss can be filled only with an infinite and immutable object. We've all experienced this desire and this emptiness of which these thinkers and these artists, these philosophers have spoken. We've tried desperately to satisfy our desires. When we were kids, we might have thought, if only my favorite team will win the World Series or win the Super Bowl, then I'll be happy, right? I thought that. Unfortunately, I wouldn't know because none of my teams have even come close to any of those. Some of us looked longingly towards marriage and said, if I can just find my spouse, then I'll be fulfilled. Some of us, it was athletic achievement. For some of us, it was the new car, the new SUV. For some of us, it was the great movie that's coming out. It was the European vacation. It was having children. It was finishing grad school. It was the perfect job. It was that really great concert. If only my mother would love me then, on and on and on. And what we realize is that all the things that we experience, all the desire and all the loneliness, only point us on to something else. Something beyond our experience, as Pascal wrote, beyond our senses, something or someone who is transcendent. So here in Isaiah 55, God addresses our desire. He addresses our emptiness, right? It's almost as if he's, in the words of a friend of mine, pushing the needle in a little deeper when we want him just to remove it. It's almost as if he wants us to feel that emptiness and to feel that desire. But then God doesn't leave us there. He makes an offer to all people. Listen, if you will, as I read another section of these verses. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen, listen to me and eat what is good, and you will delight in the richest of fare. See, I have made him a witness to the peoples, a ruler and commander of the peoples. Surely you will summon nations you know not, and nations you do not know will come running to you because the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. Let the wicked forsake their ways and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on them, and to our God, for he will freely pardon. There's a lot there, but I want to make 2 points. First is this, is that God makes an offer to the people. He makes an offer to us. He says, if you're thirsty, I've got water. If you're hungry, I've got food. It's reminiscent of Jesus' conversation with the Samaritan woman where he offers her living water. If you remember, he tells her, whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. And this offer here by Isaiah is the same. God is saying, only in me can you be, will you be satisfied. Every good thing that I've created will leave you hungry apart from me. Back to Pascal. There's a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of each man which cannot be satisfied by any created thing, but only by God the Creator, made known through Jesus Christ. Augustine, in his Confessions, agreed with Pascal, saying, thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee. Perhaps what's even more remarkable, or as remarkable, is that this offer from God is to everyone. And that's good, because we're not Jews, or at least maybe most of us aren't. In fact, what he says in these passages is to all peoples, to all nations. He even says to the wicked and to the unrighteous. There's more than a few of us in this room this morning who fall in that category as well. It's for all who recognize their spiritual bankruptcy. It's for every one of us that realize, I don't have anything to offer you, God, because everything I've got is what you've given me. In the words of Tim Keller, all you need is need, and all you need is nothing. It's free. You who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without cost, because Jesus paid it all. It's an offer of grace. It's an invitation to mercy. It's an invitation to pardon. And the offer, again, is not based on any fee or accomplishment. It's a gift and nothing more. It's an invitation also to fulfillment and to satisfaction. In essence, God is saying, I want to make you an offer to give you all that you have ever desired, satisfaction, fulfillment, unconditional acceptance, freedom from your past, all at no cost to you. And then in verse 8, it's like God realizes he's going to have to defend himself to someone making an objection. Maybe he's explaining himself to the Jews because he knows they're asking, are you kidding? You want to forgive these people? That could echo in our minds too. We could think, man, this gift should not be given to the wicked, not to the unrighteous. Or the Israelites could be thinking, you want to offer the covenant to foreigners? How could you do that? They've hated you. They've persecuted us. Or maybe for Westerners like us, maybe God is anticipating the people who say, are you kidding me? I have been too bad. There is no way you can offer me pardon. I can't be forgiven. You've no idea who I've been. You've no idea who I've done. To which God responds, for my thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are higher than your ways. That's good news. In other words, I am in charge. I am who I am. We often think God calls good people to him. We think God calls deserving people to him. We think God is like a divine kickball team captain choosing the best, but he is not. God invites all people to himself and tells both sinners and saints alike, as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. What God says goes, and he says that we are forgiven and that we are fulfilled in him. And who are we to argue with the creator of the universe?